launched. And she, in fact, Rosa Parks, launches Dr. Martin Luther King, a young pastor who just moved to town.
Right. So she's bailed out a few hours later. When Edie Nixon sees that she is okay, because that she hasn't been physically hurt, he's delighted. This could be a possible test case. She and her husband have to think. That night, she decides she will go forward. She calls a young black lawyer named Fred Gray. That night, Fred Gray calls Joanne Robinson. Joanne Robinson's the head of the Women's Political Council. They have a plan. In the middle of the night, Robinson sneaks into Alabama State where she works, and with the help of two students, runs off 35,000 leaflets. And the next morning, the women of the Women's Political Council fan out over Montgomery with those leaflets. They're originally calling for a one-day boycott.
But it ends up being a year, and 1 year later, the final result.
The buses are desegregated. It's not about walking. They organize this incredible carpool system. They set up 40 pickup stations all around the city. They're giving, at its peak, 15,000 to 20,000 rides a day. All of this, right, exceeds every time people take a step. What is imagined gets broader. And they turn it from a one-day to a year-long boycott from first come, first.
That's the story of Rosa Parks. To go to all our interviews with Jean Theo Harris on the rebellious life of Rosa Parks, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Are you ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214 to contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign, going on now until December 31st. What better way to celebrate than by gifting your loved one a KBOO membership this season?
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Metropolitan Family Services, Cache, Oregon, an economic program committed to improving the financial health of low to moderate income families by providing tax preparation services. Volunteers are currently needed to support this program. All training is provided, no tax experience necessary. More info on volunteering at cacheoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the city of Portland has a new city administrator.
Far-right media influencer Nick Sortor sues the city of Portland for $10 million.
And the wealth gap just keeps on growing.
Thank you. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 10th, 2025. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Terrence Burns. Portland City Council unanimously voted in their first permanent city administrator, Raymond Lee. Interim City Administrator Michael Jordan has been in this role since the summer of 2024, as Portland City government was making its transition into a new form of government. Lee's most recent gig was in Greeley, Colorado, a college town about a fifth the size of Portland. Here's an excerpt from his remarks to City Council this morning, starting with this, his reflection on Portland's government overhaul.
A monumental achievement for the city to transition itself to where we are today. And a lot of people don't understand what's all entailed in that. So I give kudos to this elected body for stepping into that role and to really help move this city forward in a productive way. Because there is a better way to governance. There is a better way to provide services to the community. There is a better way to help businesses grow within our community. And the individuals in this room today are helping shape that for our community. My career and why I've been driven to public service is really started at a very young age. You know, I come from a family of public administrators. My mother was a city manager. My father spent 30 years in the Dallas Fire Department. So this wasn't anything that came lightly. This is purpose-driven work for me. I truly believe this type of work is a calling for individuals to be able to step into and be able to do at a very high level. And I'm very excited about this opportunity. I'm excited about what the future has in store for this great city. I'm excited about the opportunity to be able to partner with the city council and with the mayor to really shape what that future would be for Portland. I must say this is a pivotal time for this city. There is a tremendous amount of things that are happening right now. Portland has that spotlight. And everybody is watching how this city will be able to maneuver through this. Is this a new way of providing services? Is this a new way of governing an organization in a city? This will be the test model, and all of us are in this together. And I'm willing to be a willing partner with this council and with the mayor to help shape what that will look like for us as we move forward.
That was newly minted Portland City Administrator Raymond Lee addressing Portland City Council this morning. He responded to questions from councilors who have been a big part of the overhaul of city government. Multiple councilors expressed frustration over on how to deal with city bureaucracy. They are allowed to ask questions or allowed to ask city staff questions about legislations. How will the city administrator keep the councilors informed? Councilor Candace Avalos from District 1 told Lee that what she hoped from him in his new role.
Congratulations on your appointment as administrator. As you have heard from all of us, this is a really pivotal moment for our city, and your leadership is going to help shape how this new form of government comes to life. As we continue implementing this historic transition, I expect you to lead in this new system. Portlanders need an administrator who is committed to making this government work as intended, with clearer accountability, stronger coordination, and a partnership built on trust between the executive and the legislative branches. I also want to emphasize the importance of accessibility. Portlanders deserve an administrator who is present, who listens, who understands the lived experiences of the people that we serve. And so I expect you to do the hard work of getting to know our communities across neighborhoods, languages, cultures, identities, and to make yourself genuinely accessible to the public. Finally, I also hope that you will help be a bridge between our two branches of government. As you can hear from my colleagues, we don't feel that that bridge is strong right now, and you're coming at a pivotal moment where we expect you to urgently take the lead on how to strengthen that bridge between our government. Success under this new model requires collaboration and transparency and shared understanding of our goals, as you know, and so I look forward to working with you in that spirit.
Lee made commitments to greater transparency for city council and public going forward. The city councilors voted Lee into the role of city administrator by unanimous vote. He'll start later this month.
A new report finds a proposed renewable diesel plant along the Columbia River would not be as sustainable as Next Renewable Fuels claims. Over 90% of the plant's fuel would come from crops grown specifically for fuel instead of waste oils, swelling the facility's carbon footprint. Isabel Charlet reports.
A proposed renewable diesel plant on the Columbia River would likely not live up to its promise of supporting Oregon's emissions goals, according to a new report. The Next Renewable Fuels refinery near Clatskanie would produce 50,000 barrels of diesel daily. Audrey Leonard of Columbia Riverkeeper, which released the report, says over 90% of the facility's fuel would come from high-carbon crops like soy and canola, not the low-carbon waste oils it promotes.
Next, we'll have a really difficult time sourcing enough of the truly low-carbon feedstocks to make the amount of fuel that it plans to make. If Next has to rely on these higher carbon feedstocks, that will make their fuel less competitive and less valuable in markets that reward the truly low carbon fuels.
She explains that sustainable sources like used cooking oil are limited in supply and they're more expensive because they are incentivized by large markets like California's. Columbia Riverkeeper is currently challenging two of the facility's permits in court. Leonard says when thinking about a fuel's carbon footprint, it is important to take into account the emissions from every step of production. That includes the energy it takes to grow and ship the crops, turn them into oil, and process that oil into diesel.
In this case, Next would be powered by fracked gas and would emit up to 1 million tons of greenhouse gases per year, using the same amount of gas as the city of Eugene.
Along with carrying a big carbon footprint, Leonard claims it's hard to find a worse place to build this refinery. She explains the proposed site is on unstable, waterlogged soil that supports local farmland and will likely liquefy in the event of a large earthquake. She adds the facility would mean more boat traffic on the Columbia River.
Anytime you have more ships in the Columbia, you have an increased spill risk and increased effects to the habitat in the river.
Next has plans to build a similar facility in Lakeview, Oregon. Leonard says the company's past should serve as a warning, noting its backers were involved in a failed 2014 biodiesel plant in Odessa, Washington, that left behind a costly Superfund cleanup for the state, along with unpaid local bills and taxes. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
More than 5,000 people experience homelessness in Portland every night. New revelations from a departing director of the Housing Bureau demonstrate the city has a previously unknown $21 million in unspent housing funds. Now Portland City Councilors are trying to decide where those dollars get spent. The Housing and Homelessness Committee referred to a resolution to the bill to the full City Council to spend that money on rent stabilization to slow the flow into homelessness, due in part to a lack of affordable housing. All three East Portland councilors, Candace Avalos, Jamie Dunphy, and Loretta Smith, advocated for the council vote. Councilor Avalos told OPB, quote, "Right now, in this moment, our responsibility is simple. Stop people from falling into homelessness. I believe we can choose a future where housing is a human right, not something you earn by surviving impossible odds," end quote. Councilor Smith agreed, saying, quote, "It's one thing to give people a place to stay at night, but when those folks have to leave at 6 a.m., they don't have nowhere to go. The reason why our shelter system is not working is because those folks have to wander around for hours before they can get back into our system." Smith continued, quote, "Month after month, more Portlanders fall into homelessness than we can house. If we can only treat the symptoms, we'll never solve the problem," end quote. Former Portland Housing Bureau Director Helmi Heisrich uncovered the unspent money thanks to an audit she asked for last summer before her resignation. The unspent $21 million was generated by the rental services fee, a nominal fee assessed to landlords for doing business in the city since 2018. The council resolution listed federal policy shifts as the main contributors to the housing instability, including reductions in housing and urban development funding, low-income housing tax credits, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The resolution will require support from Portland Mayor Keith Wilson during the next budgeting cycle. Wilson's spokesperson, Cody Bowman shared in an email that the mayor shares similar properties. However, City Council's intent plays a role in how Mayor Wilson's develops upcoming budget priorities.
A far-right media influencer from Washington, D.C., who was briefly placed in custody in early October and not charged with a crime, filed a tort claim on Monday, signaling his intent to sue Portland. Nick Sortor says his civil rights were violated by the Portland Police Bureau during an October 2nd arrest in front of the ICE facility on South McAdam Avenue. Sortor was placed in custody following a reportedly heated argument with protesters who opposed the Trump administration's deportation efforts. One of the protesters allegedly pushed Sortor with an umbrella and another swung a stick at him. But Nick Sortor was never charged with a crime. The Multnomah County District Attorney's Office reported the evidence showed Sortor was justifiably acting in defense. Prosecutors charged the other two protesters with disorderly conduct. Sortor's attorney, Angus Lee, told Coin6, quote, "This wrongful arrest was not just a mistake. It was the product of a deeply embedded culture of political discrimination in Portland law enforcement," end quote. Lee is also the attorney who had previously represented another far-right activist and Patriot Prayer leader, Joey Gibson. In a 32-page document, Lee formalized his client's intention to sue for $10 million and went on to detail what he claims is a longstanding pattern and practice of hostility towards conservative political viewpoints.
President Trump asserts he's bringing economic gains in Pennsylvania as families nationwide continue to grapple with rising medical, utility, and energy costs. However, economists counter that emergency payments don't address underlying problems. In states and local organizations, expand relief efforts and push for new customer protections. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Now, after just 10 months in office, I'm pleased to report that America is winning again, Pennsylvania is prospering again, and I will not rest until this Commonwealth is wealthier and stronger than ever before.
With his approval on the economy down sharply, President Donald Trump is using a trip to Pennsylvania to confront charges he's failing struggling farmers and working families. Trump had called affordability a, quote, Democratic hoax and had said farmers would benefit, not suffer, from his trade wars. The USDA is getting ready to roll out aid Trump is creating to offset farm losses connected to tariffs and falling exports. But Ben Lilliston with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy says emergency payments don't fix low crop prices and rising input costs.
It doesn't address the underlying problems. And really, the big one is increased costs. And many of those costs are associated with these tariffs. So higher prices for machinery, for crop inputs.
Advocates are worried about shortfalls in federal energy crisis assistance. Community agencies say the demand for LIHEAP is surging as prices rise and winter intensifies. Lynette Lowe with the Association of Community Ministries in Kentucky says many families struggle just to keep the lights and heat on.
We have almost 60,000 households just in Metro Louisville who are experiencing that kind of burden. They pay more than 10% of their income just to have utilities in their household.
Kentucky organizations are urging Governor Andy Beshear to issue a moratorium on utility shutoffs through March 2026. With the administration backing away from climate action, attention is shifting to states. Nolan Rutschling with the Ohio Environmental Council says the state is making bipartisan progress, increasing renewables, modernizing the grid, and cutting costs for consumers.
I think Ohioans know this already, but we're in the midst of an affordability crisis. In Ohio, costs are very, very high due to the fact that we aren't bringing enough power onto the grid to meet demand.
One recently passed law ends longstanding coal bailouts and prioritizes development on brownfields and former coal sites. Christmas is coming early for thousands of families in Los Angeles, as LA County is erasing more than $350 million in medical debt through a partnership with a nonprofit. Undue medical debt buys past due accounts for pennies on the dollar, targeting people with little hope of paying. Allison Sesso is the group's president.
There is no action an individual can take to buy this debt on their own, and there's nothing anybody has to do to get this relief. They just have to receive a letter and know that that debt has been relieved and they're free and clear of it.
The National Institutes of Health says medical debt accounts for 4 in 10 consumer bankruptcies. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. KBOO reporter Hannah Francis sits down with Jake Thomas from Street Roots for the latest about his reporting. At 6, it's Flashpoints, then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, expect cloudy conditions overnight with a low temperature of 56. Tomorrow, look for morning showers with more clouds and an afternoon high of 58 degrees. Today in history, the first film in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Fellowship of the Ring, was released in 2001. The quote of the day is from Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman elected to the U.S. Congress. She said, quote, "If they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair."
Peer support specialists offer a different kind of support from therapists or psychiatrists. And in Alaska, there are state certifications for peer support roles, including a special track for Indigenous people with lived experience in recovery. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For people experiencing addiction, it can help to talk to someone who's been through recovery themselves. Peer support specialists offer a different kind of support from therapists or psychiatrists. And in Alaska, there are state certificates for peer support roles, including a special track for Indigenous people with lived experience in recovery. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has more on peer-to-peer care in the state.
Josh Engel is bundled up on one of the first really cold days in October to do outreach in a homeless encampment in Anchorage. He approaches a man in a weathered coat.
How long have you been out here on the streets?
Too long.
Yeah? You connected with any resources?
Engel is a manager and peer support specialist at True North Recovery in Wasilla. One of his aims today is to help guide people into recovery. It's a path Engel knows well because he's in long-term recovery himself. Now, he supports people in ways that go well beyond what a more traditional therapist or psychiatrist can do. He may text with clients outside business hours, help them find work or get connected with benefits, anything that supports them in a way that might lead to recovery.
I personally really enjoy being able to connect with them on like a personal level of someone that has walked their path.
When patients interact with workers with lived experience, research shows it can aid recovery and can reduce healthcare costs. Aaron Surma is executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, in Juneau, and Surma experiences mental illness himself. He says psychiatrists and mental health professionals play an important role in supporting recovery and treatment, but there is a strong power difference.
The dynamic is that you have the expert and the person who needs help.
Surma says he was arrested multiple times during high school and was court-ordered to go to Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous meetings. He says hearing peers in those groups was awesome, but things felt different when talking with his formal providers.
When I was a teenager, I was lighting stuff on fire and buying garbage bags of weed. So then to go into a small room and talk to somebody, it's a million miles from what you know.
He says it's easier for peers to bridge those gaps in early recovery. Peer support specialists speak the language of addiction and mental illness and also understand the more traditional language of behavioral health professionals. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Seeds of Eden, which offers addiction recovery services and community-based behavioral health services, recently received a $30,000 grant from the South Dakota Community Foundation. The grant will help the organization with its work to provide sober living, peer support, care coordination, and case management, including a project to build a recovery housing facility on the Standing Rock Reservation on the South Dakota side. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe straddles the South Dakota and North Dakota border. Isaiah Keller is one of the co-founders of Seeds of Eden. He says they've already secured a home, which is being remodeled to offer future services.
The house that we have been remodeling is about 90% complete. A small portion of the funds that were awarded will go to finish that house and to make it livable and to make it functional.
Keller says Seeds of Eden was designed to help fill a gap when it comes to addiction recovery services, and he says the group realized there was a need for assistance within tribal communities. He says they've been working closely with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Native American board members, and Native advocates.
We've partnered with a really good ally and advocate, and her name's Bobby Jamerson. She has been advocating and promoting recovery and community involvement. We're at a point right now where we feel like we have some great traction and some great movement.
Keller says they'd like to expand services across South Dakota and beyond. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The federal government denied a petition to list Western Pacific Coastal Chinook salmon as endangered. A group of environmental nonprofits filed the petition in 2022, originally aiming to protect spring run fish along the Oregon coast and part of Northern California. Experts say those Chinook are more threatened by habitat changes than fish that return in the fall. Spring run Chinook come back from the ocean much earlier than the other salmon, staying in deep water pools until the fall. The fish then often head further upstream to spawn. Jeff Miller from the Center for Biological Diversity said, quote, spring run salmon are blocked in their migration to where they ideally want to go. A lot of their former spawning habitat is blocked above major dams, end quote. The National Marine Fisheries Service acknowledged spring run Chinook faced greater threats like rising water temperatures and habitat loss. But the agency refused to split the spring and fall run populations into two distinct groups. In issuing its decision, the agency said, quote, factors leading to this conclusion include the lack of spring run specific habitat in most of the river systems and the lack of strong evidence that the spring run was ever historically a substantial component, end quote. The nonprofits originally only wanted to protect the spring run Chinook, but since the government would not split up the two populations, the groups had to petition for an endangered species listing that included both. In addition, recent studies have found major genetic differences between the two populations, which some feel justifies protecting just the spring run salmon. Miller said his organization is looking at challenging this decision and possibly seeking state-level protections.
The just-released third edition of the World Inequality Report says wealth growth has been the strongest for the world's ultra-rich. So essentially, the richest 0.001% of the world's population, that's fewer than 60,000 multimillionaires, have three times more wealth than the poorest half of the world's population combined. The richest 10% of the global population own three-quarters of the world's wealth and capture more income than the rest of humanity. The report states, quote, inequality has long been a defining feature of global economy, but by 2025 it has reached levels that demand urgent attention. This concentration is not only persistent, but it's also accelerating. The report went on to say, the benefits of globalization and economic growth have flowed disproportionately to a small minority, while much of the world's population still faces difficulty in achieving stable livelihoods, end quote. Wealth, or the value of people's assets, was even more concentrated than income, or earnings from work and investments, the report found, with the richest 10% of the world's population owning 75% of wealth, and the bottom half possessed just 2%. Looking beyond economic inequality, the report found inequality of opportunity fuels inequality of outcomes, with education spending per child in Europe and North America more than 40 times that in sub-Saharan Africa. That's a gap roughly three times greater than GDP per capita. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz called for an international panel comparable to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to track worldwide inequality and provide objective, evidence-based recommendations.
The holiday shopping season is here, and scammers are using this time of year to their advantage. Some tips can help people avoid falling prey to fraudsters. Eric Tegedoff reports from North Carolina.
Scammers are kicking their operations into high gear for the holidays, and consumers in North Carolina and across the country should be on high alert. Criminals looking to steal from people use the hectic holiday season to try and catch their victims off guard. Joe Mecca with the North Carolina-based Coastal Credit Union says fraudsters have been calling people and saying they're from a local financial institution.
They will call, they'll pretend to be with your credit union or with your bank, and they might say that they've discovered some fraudulent activity on your account or they're attempting to prevent some fraud. It's a social engineering scam, so what they're trying to do is they're trying to get you to provide your information.
Mecca notes this is not something legitimate institutions like Coastal Credit Union will do. He says people should be suspicious of such calls. He also says callers who make urgent requests where people are pressured to send money to them immediately should be avoided. Mecca says Facebook Marketplace can be a source for scams, and he advises people who make purchases there to collect them in person if it's local, and pay in cash. Common online scams include non-delivery scams, in which an item is paid for but never delivered, and non-payment scams, in which you sell something online and ship it but never receive payment. Mecca discusses some red flags to watch out for.
They may want you to ship that item right away. They may request to pay from an unusual source like a wire transfer or a gift card or crypto. Or they may overpay you and request a refund. All those should be red flags that you are either going to be out the money or attempted to be scammed. So we tell people to watch out for those.
Mecca advises people not to click on suspicious links and to shop safely online.
If you're shopping online, always verify the website. Make sure it's a secure site. Make sure it's a legitimate website. So double check the address. A lot of times they'll spoof a legitimate website with something that looks like it's coming from a website that you know, but it might not be.
For North Carolina News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants Santa to bring him a DC.
War Department, Injustice Department, Department of Homeland Intimidation, Department of Interior Exploitation, of Labor Suppression. How can I minimize the effects of Trump on my life when I have no idea what's going on? I do know that whatever the feds are telling me isn't true, that whatever the Democrats are accused of doing, the Republicans are doing more. Trump's foreign policy statement boils down to, if you're not subservient, you're against us. Fortress America, kick-ass America, the world's America's open pit mine. We have most of what we need, including people, and everything else we can take. While internally, the Supreme Court is steamrolling the Constitution to pave the way for a unitary executive led by a narcissist with rapidly declining mental and physical health. They've only told